Hello, and welcome to the Slightly Foxed Summer Podcast, brought to you from the Slightly Foxed offices here in London. I'm Rosie Goldsmith. In this episode, we'll be discussing the remarkable life and novels of Barbara Cummins. Now, if like me, you knew little about her, prepare to be captivated and surprised, and perhaps even shocked. But let me just say here and now, how did I not know about her? We've invited her biographer, Avril Horner, and the manager of Daunt Books, Brett Wollstonecroft, to accompany us on this Barbara Cummins journey of discovery, and perhaps rediscovery for some of you. Welcome to Avril, and welcome to Brett.
Hello.
Hello.
Wonderful. Now, discovery and rediscovery, those very key words, are part of the very DNA of Slightly Foxed. And before we embark on our latest book tour, let's introduce our regular guests, Slightly Foxed editors, Gail Perkis and Hazelwood. Welcome back to you. You're here to bring us up to date on Foxed news and to fill in the last 3 months since I last saw you. Great to see you again. I can't believe how quickly.
I know. Time has flown.
Time flies. Actually, before we start with Fox News, tell me, did you, like me, not know Barbara Cummins, or had you read Barbara Cummins? Come clean. Gail.
We had an article on Our Spoons Came from Woolworths about 6 or 7 years ago, and I had never heard of her. So when Avril's biography came out, it was a revelation.
Brilliant. I mean, I feel less alone then, because I was going to think, shall I be honest about it or not? But yeah, I'm very honest. I hadn't heard of her before. Now I've read a lot.
I must say, she was just Hazel. A name, really, at the back of my mind. And as Gail says, we've had a piece about her, but somehow, it hadn't taken, really. But yes, it is a revelation to read about her. Fascinating.
Now, looking forward to hearing more of your views on Barbara Cummins later, Gail and Hazel. But first of all, what's been happening in the world of Slightly Foxed?
Well, as everybody knows, we're celebrating our 20th year. And to do that, we have launched an online auction to raise money for Book Trust, which is the biggest UK reading charity for children. And we're hoping to raise at least £10,000. The online auction has already started. You can buy tickets online for £5 each. And there are some fantastic prizes. So there's a complete set of back issues, which we're going to donate, a complete set of all the plain Fox editions that we've published. There are various free nights at various literary places. So there's two nights at the Gladstone Library up in Wales, two nights in a railway carriage in Norfolk, four nights at a reading retreat down in Cornwall, and a lot of lovely prizes.
This is really wonderful.
I suppose we're now all online, so it seemed a good thing to do. So I really hope people support it. It started at the beginning of this month and will finish on the 16th of September, and we'll do the draw on the 17th of September.
Excellent.
So that's the first thing. We're also busy organising Reader's Day, which is going to be on Saturday the 2nd of November. And tickets are on sale from the beginning of August.
So now, Reader's Day, just to interrupt, it's a bit like your festival,
yes,
isn't it?
It's
your
a annual festival. So it's five or six speakers at the Art Workers Guild in Queen Square. Some people come every year. Some people come from America, from France. We've only got 95 tickets, so if you'd like to come, you'd be most welcome, but you do need to get your ticket quite soon.
And it's nice because we're not, trying to sell anything.
Hazel, your book sales.
Well, I mean in the sense
surely.
That... No, but with our speakers, they're not chosen because necessarily they've got a new book, but just because they've got something interesting to say, so...
Excellent.
It makes it less of a bun fight.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much for that. Hazel, any more news from you?
Well, just to get down to the sort of nitty-gritty, really, we've, as usual, a lot of our work is reading the proofs and putting together the issue and...
The magazine.
The magazine, yes, which is, I think it's a very good one. I've written a piece about an author called Dorothy Whipple. Mm. And people who are mad about Dorothy Whipple are absolutely mad about her, I know. And when she was an established novelist, she wrote her autobiography of her early life. And it's a very lovely book, nothing happens, yet everything happens somehow. On the surface, it was a rather idyllic childhood, but underneath, of course, I think she says something like, children suffer a great deal that adults know nothing of. And really, in a way, that's the theme of it, although it's very, very wryly funny.
And there's so much about children in Barbara Cummins' novels too, lots to talk about.
So we're reissuing the other day in a limited edition. So that'll be our autumn Slightly Fox edition.
I look forward to reading that
very much.
We've
got some other fun pieces as well. There's a piece about the literary rectory.
Wonderful. I'm coming from a family of vicars and so on, and cold, vicarages. Yes. I will love that. Yes. I think a few other hands have gone up around the table too.
Yes, and Mr. Norris. We've got Mr. Norris changes trains. Very nice.
Great.
And Barbara Tuckman's August 1914.
Oh, that's a wonderful book.
Which is
that's
a great
Brett
book.
Chipping in there. I think we all want to just say this all sounds so fantastic. Yes.
As usual, a real variety of subjects and
really exciting. Thank you so much for that. That's our Foxed News. And now back to Barbara.
Da-da.
Artist, sculptor, writer, kennel maid, dog breeder, antique dealer, interior decorator, property manager, piano restorer, cook, housekeeper, mother, wife, lover, grandmother. Barbara Cummins was an amazing woman. She also published 9 novels, her very first at the age of 40 in 1947 and her last in 1985. She also wrote a biography and one short memoir. She lived from 1907 to 1992 and was frankly unique, a true original. Her friend and fellow novelist Ursula Holden put it this way: Barbara Cummins deftly balances savagery with innocence, depravity with gothic interludes. Isn't that fantastic? We see that balance of savagery and innocence in Avril Horner's new biography of Barbara Cummins called A Savage Innocence. What a title. Avril, welcome back to the fold. Now, you've done us all such a great service writing this great biography. Who was Barbara Cummins and where did she come from? Where was she born?
She was born in a very pretty village called Bidford-on-Avon in Warwickshire, and she was one of 6 children. There was one boy and 5 girls, and a lovely big house. They were fairly comfortably off because her father had patented a brewing process which made him quite wealthy. But then later on, when Barbara was in her teens, things began to go wrong and the money was a problem, and her father quarrelled with her mother and there were lots of domestic incidents which upset her. She was a very beautiful child, as was her younger sister Chloe. Chloe was very tall and actually got modelling work later when she was an adult. Barbara was shorter, about 5'4", brown limpid eyes, thick brown wavy hair, and one can imagine a very lively manner. You know, from her humour in the books and her wit, one can imagine that she was a funny person, a good person to have a conversation with. She's also slightly rebellious. She used to swing on the swing so high that one day she crashed through a window in the house, and she used to go throwing stones on the village doors sometimes, you know. So she had quite a privileged upbringing in some ways, but not an emotionally secure one.
Tell us more about writing the biography and how you came to discover Barbara Cummins.
I discovered Barbara Cummins a long time ago, about 20 years ago, when a colleague I was co-authoring things with suggested we write something on Barbara Cummins. We were invited by a journal who was doing special issue on female Gothic to submit an essay.
That's your big area, female Gothic writing.
And we thought, you know, we'd done Daphne du Maurier, everyone's done Wollstonecraft, you know, what can we do that's fresh?
Not Brent Wollstonecraft.
No. Although it would have been an honour, I'm sure. And Sue, my friend, had just read The Vet's Daughter and she passed it over and I was absolutely astonished. So I then read The Skin Chairs and some others and we wrote an article for this journal. But I was in full-time work, had children, lots of big projects, then ran the Research Institute, and I just didn't have time to get back to Barbara Cummins in any depth. But I always thought, I knew bits about her life from Wikipedia, and I thought, my goodness, what an extraordinary life and what an extraordinary author. So it wasn't until I retired and had finished other projects that I thought, right, now I shall do it for pleasure, just for pleasure. And things fell in very nicely. I discovered that her son, who is now 92 and very frail, lived only 20 minutes from where I live in Kingston-upon-Thames. He was very keen to meet me. And then I met her granddaughter, who lives in Shropshire, and they both had letters dating back to the 1930s in Nuria, particularly in a box room.
She's the granddaughter.
In a box room, higgledy-piggledy, no order, just stuffed into carrier bags and boxes under the bed. So I would go and stay for 3 or 4 days at a time and work my way through them and transcribe. And I thought, this is what an extraordinary... These, and some of the letters were... You know, they made me gasp when I read them. So it was a pleasure to write. It took 5 or 6 years to write. But getting it published was a real challenge because no one had heard of Barbara Cummins. You know, you both candidly admitted that you hadn't either. So
well, that's although me I, and Gail.
Yes. Mm. So although I'd published with Chateau Windus before, you know, the editor there said, it's too much of a risk. You know, they liked the way it was written, but it was just too much of a risk. And that was the problem. I think big publishers are quite risk averse these days. Mm-hmm. So in the end, Manchester University Press published it. So I just thought she needed recognition, and I wanted more people to read her books because they are a joy to read. Sometimes shocking, but they are.
That word,
a joy
I did
to
use
read.
The word shocking very mm-hmm. deliberately because they are quite shocking. And yes. I know we'll talk about that mm-hmm. later. But if I could ask you before we go on to talk about specific books and style and so on too. How would you sum her up? What was it that grabbed you about her? And why should we be reading her?
She's sui generis, which means she can't be categorised, really. So when you ask me to categorise, it's very difficult because she draws on the uncanny, she draws on the Gothic tradition, and yet she can write very well within the realist mode. She ranges across various effects. She is startling to read because of those stylistic shifts. She's also... It's surprising how she switches tone within a couple of paragraphs so that one moment you're laughing and the next moment you're thinking, my God, this poor woman, she's on the edge of something or other, you know. I just thought she was an experimental writer who should be recognised as contributing to the evolution of the novel in the UK.
My job is done. almost. Actually, but that is a wonderful start to this discussion. Gail, you wanted to
say
anything?
Well, I think that... I mean, one of the wonderful things about the biography is the way it informs the novels, because she, I mean, her life was absolutely extraordinary. And how on earth did you untangle a chronology for somebody who had multiple affairs, lived in goodness knows how many different places, not to mention moving country? I mean, I lost count of how many times she moved. And all the things that she did because she was so desperately poor for so long and turned her hand and seemed undaunted and just kept on.
There were a number of sources I used. I mean, I obviously used the letters very heavily. Her son wrote a memoir, which is not... It's never been published, but it was very useful. So it was a matter of pulling all these threads together and double-checking.
Yes.
Because sometimes someone would tell you something, you raise your eyebrows and think, really? And then you check with someone else and no, that wasn't right. So I did a lot of fact-checking. I wanted her to speak for herself and I wanted her friends and her lovers to speak for themselves and the reader to work out what they thought the truth was.
Yes.
It is a wonderful biography. I mean, it really is. So many, many congratulations from all of us. And it's started us all reading Barbara Cummins as well. Now, Brett, you've been nodding and agreeing with Avril all along the way.
It's a wonderful book. It has again brought her right to the front of people's attention, which is fantastic.
I hope people read the biography but also read the books. Oh, and Daunce has just, well, over the last year or two,
we've got two and it'd be lovely to have more. We've got two of them, Who Was Changed and Who Was Dead, and then we did A Touch of Mistletoe, but again we're just publishing for the same reason. They're constantly astonishing books. I think somewhere in her life she talks about in one of the novels, maybe, but she lives in a flat where it's mostly in shade, but there's dappled sunlight coming through. I think that's how I think of her books. I mean, there are these astonishing dapples of sunlight through them, through what is they're quite shady, but also breathtakingly funny at times. So yeah, she's a wonderful writer who we're delighted to republish.
You know. How have they gone down with readers?
Very, very well. I think people often have come across the more sort of British magical surrealist side of her, and so when you get to the more heartbreakingly realistic novels like Our Spoons and then later on A Touch of Mistletoe, I think there is an understanding that she had all these terrifically different styles, but she's attracted a huge new following, certainly in these editions that we've done. And as I say, it would be lovely to publish more.
So, I mean, there have been several reissues recently. Mm. But in fact, the copies that I've been reading from, I've had an old Virago modern classic of Our Spoons Came from Woolworths, which is how I got to know so many women writers back in the day, and still reading those beautiful books. And they've reissued, I think, some of the Turnpike has actually published The House of Dolls.
And Mr. Fox.
And Mr. Fox. Mm. So of the 9 novels, how many have not been reissued?
Well, the one I would really like to see reissued, and I'm looking at Brett here, is The Skin Chairs. It's a very challenging novel in many ways, but I think publishers are perhaps unduly nervous about it because the skin chairs are covered with human skin. They're trophies from the Boer War. But like many of Barbara's books, it's a book that looks at the whole spectrum of cruelty, from children being badly treated at home to the atrocities in war. And why we should be afraid of that now, looking at what's happened in Ukraine, and there are still atrocities committed in war, and it's a book about that, but it too has its comic moments, and the ending is extraordinary, because the young heroine, and she's only a girl, baptises these chairs and then reads the burial service, and if you like puts those souls to rest. It's very moving and extraordinary original ending. But there are others like Out of the Red and Into the Blue, and it's quite hard to get hold of, Birds in Tiny Cages. Sometimes you can get them for an extravagant price on eBay, but those are the three that are, certainly The Skin Chairs, any second-hand copies have gone now, and the last one I think went for £100-something.
Gail, you do actually sell, on your online bookshop, you sell one of her books, don't you?
Yes, A Touch of Mistletoe, which has done very well. And
well, Brett will be pleased to hear that.
And Dawn, as a result of this podcast, we will have on the website whatever else is available as a new book, but obviously can't do much about the second-hand ones.
So, I mean, Avril, has The Vet's Daughter been reissued? Is that your favourite?
It's always been available. As far as I know, it's never been out of print. And it's the one that I think grabs readers' attention. It's short, it's powerful, it's surreal, and it has a scene of levitation. The young woman, the heroine, is brought up in a house where her father is a brute, and her mother, who she loves very much, dies of cancer. In fact, the father is a vet, and he literally puts down the mother like you would an animal one night, and the mother has cancer. So again, it's shocking, but also very funny in places. And this young woman, Alice Rowlands, is desperately unhappy at home, and various things happen, and to cut a long story short, she is sent away to be a lady's companion. She is courted by a young man called Henry Peebles, whom she finds rather boring. She falls in love when she's on Hailing Island, being a lady's companion, with a young man who treats her badly. One of the most shocking scenes is that her father's mistress, after her mother dies, her father takes a mistress, and the mistress is rather a blousy woman and very insensitive, and she tries to set up this young woman, Alice, with a young waiter she knows, and the young waiter tries to rape her. And after that, Alice is so shaken and so frightened, she goes to the woman she is very, very fond of, and that happens to be the cleaner of her house, Mrs. Churchill. Alice goes there for refuge, and when she's staying there overnight, she has a strange sensation of rising, and she actually levitates. She levitates, and she knows she's levitating because she can touch the gas mantle. My grandmother had a gas mantle, the way of lighting rooms in those days. And then she comes back, and in the morning she knows it's happened because she can see the powder on the floor from the gas mantle interior. Now, this is extraordinary. If you're a very down-to-earth reader who can't be doing with anything that challenges the imagination, you think this is nonsense. And some people do think it's nonsense. But of course, in many ways, it's just a metaphor for a post-traumatic state, when you dissociate yourself from that awful episode by going into another space, becoming something else, shutting down or levitating. And every other time she levitates in the book, you can usually track something that's deeply wounded her. And the ending is tragic. It's the only really tragic ending in Barbara Cummins' novels. Our Spoons, for example, ends quite happily. And others end, like Touch of Mistletoe, with a resolution to get on with life and cope by yourself. But The Vet's Daughter has a really tragic ending. And it's almost Blakean. It's a mystical Blakean ending in which her father takes advantage of her. and tries to sell her levitation ability by making it happen as an event on Clapham Common, and, yeah. and she dies. So it's a bit of a spoiler, I'm afraid, but it wouldn't spoil reading the book, which is... I recommend it to many people.
And I think it's really helpful to hear you describe it like that, because also one thing I want to bring in... Don't worry, creak away. Have a good creak.
It's one creak.
I noticed mine creaked. Yeah.
They're very creaky chairs. But you mentioned William Blake, and there are so many other references. I was thinking of Chagall, of course, and the levitating, and surrealism as such. Now, she was... an artist, first and foremost, and then she became a writer. She didn't publish until she was 40, her first book. Yes. So surrealism and art, such a key component of her life. And can you tell us a little bit about that? Because you do cover the London group, the arts group, the art group that she belonged to, and various other artists that she met and lived with. She wanted to become a sculptress and a painter. Absolutely integral to her life.
Yes, I think so. I mean, very early on, she wanted to be an artist, and she went to art school in Stratford after her father died and her mother moved, but only for a term. Later, when she inherited some money from her father, she paid for Heatherley's art school in London, which still exists and where I got some of the photos and information from. It's independent art school. She went there, and then... as you know, her life became very complicated and involved. And to be a woman artist, you need material. You know, you need clay, you need space, you need an easel, you need paints. So it's quite difficult, I think, for women whose life falls into a series of disasters, which is what happened to her, to continue.
She never
that.
Had any money. So to be a sculptor, you need to have
that's
clay,
right.
as you say.
And she married young, and her husband, John Pemberton, was convinced that he would be a great artist.
And of course, she was a woman.
So he put himself first. And insisted on not going out to work. He did have one job at one point, but it didn't last for long. He insisted he must paint and make his name. So she was the one who got a job in a commercial art studio and went out to work as an artist model and did all sorts of things. But I think because they moved in artistic circles, because her first husband, uncle was Rupert Lee, who was president of the London Group, they met a lot of artists and they were aware and interested in changing currents in the art world. So even though surrealism as a movement wasn't really known in Britain in the 1920s, they picked it up because they met artists who lived in Paris or came across from Paris.
But there was a big exhibition, a very important
1936,
exhibition in London.
Yes. The London Group organised the International Surrealist Exhibition in 1936, which was really an eye-opener. It had very mixed reviews because some people thought it was bonkers, you know, but it had a huge number of people go to the exhibition, and it had a very great impact on Barbara. In one of the novels, she talks about going there, and it gave her another eye to see the world with.
Which really helps, doesn't it, everyone, that to understand Barbara Cummins' novels, I think, to know that she loved surrealism and the uncanny, and she really connected with it. And as you say, possibly it was also an escape for her from the grim reality. Yes. There's a lot of grim. I mean, grim is one of the words I keep thinking of in her life. And, you know, we use the word shocked, but, you know, if you read that she was writing about some of the most dire poverty in the 1930s in London. There's nothing romantic about it at all. Yeah. And her, I think, unique ability to confront poverty and cruelty and the suffering of children and women, childbirth, abuse, and mental illness as well. Mm. It's not always easy to read, is it, Brett?
No, it's absolutely not always to read. I mean, I think she's one of the greatest writers on childhood and poverty that I've ever read, and certainly the poverty, as you say, she doesn't romanticise it at all. I mean, cooking with a candle, cooking with a single candle, and you come across that several times, and it's astonishing to think that that's clearly from her own lived experience as well. It is absolutely shocking. And the NHS, the absence of the NHS. So it's such a harsh, such a cruel world. And the endless moving too. I mean, moving the
Gail
whole
was
time.
Talking about the endless moving, not just from town, country, from flat to flat, because you couldn't afford
and
to.
And constantly trying to make a home and redecorating and
upgrading, I mean, and downgrading, depending on what you had that week or that month.
She was so resourceful, wasn't she?
She was.
I mean, that's what amazed me, that she sort of renewed herself all the time, which I found quite fantastic.
I think as I read it, I mean, it may be slightly trite, but I mean, given that she was writing about, you know, an era of empire, you know, one thinks with her writing of Kipling, you know, and if, you know, treating triumph and disaster mm-hmm. as whatever the two imposters, whatever it is with. And that's what happens in her books, I think. You know, she simply ploughs on. You get a triumph and then you get a disaster and then you get a triumph.
Sometimes
and then
in another the same disaster. Sentence, you know, yeah. which is her gift.
And it's the way that she simply carries on. I guess a wartime generation, I guess one used to lots of shocks and lots of setbacks, that post-First World War generation without men, mm-hmm. Where women had to carry on. I guess that must have formed her in many ways, but it's astonishing to read.
I must say, reading Our Spoons Came from Woolworths, my Virago Modern Classics edition here in front of me, I mean, it was very hard to read. And I wonder whether you all felt that as well, that some of her novels are just so grim. Hazel, Gail?
Yes, terrible. I mean, you know, the sort of treatment in hospital and everything was just very hard reading, really, because, you know, you do get sort of identified with her, I think.
Gail?
I was so relieved reading the biography to discover that at the end of her life, you know, she found some stability and wealth and that it all came right in the end. It was such a relief because Our Spoons Came from Woolworths, I mean, half of me thought, for goodness sake, brace up and stop making the wrong decisions and going around with the wrong men. And the other half of me just felt, you know, thank goodness I was never in that sort of situation.
Now, we've mentioned children quite a lot already, and I think we need to talk a lot more about children, because not only are there so many children in her novels, but she's often described as having a childlike narrative approach. And I wondered whether that was something she just admired, the way children spoke, with the simplicity and the clarity of children, or whether... And whether she was trying to reproduce that, what the reason for that was.
I think she was. I mean, she told Ursula Holden that she thought children were straightforward. They just told it as they saw it. And I think that's what she aimed for in her novels, particularly when she writes about young women in desperate situation. The straightforward frankness of the descriptions, and they are first-person narrative, you know, they're told by the figure, it's overwhelming, really, sometimes, because the suffering and the happiness or whatever comes through very directly. Yes, but she did think, again, Blakean, she thought children, like Blake, she thought children had a visionary gaze on the world. It was untainted by growing older and becoming mature. So, yes.
What a skill to write in that way. And, in fact, I've just opened Chapter 9 of Our Spoons Came from Woolworths, which is a remarkable book for me. And this is how she writes. This is in the first person. As you say, most of the novels are in the first person. This book does not seem to be growing very large, although I've got to chapter 9. I think this is partly because there isn't any conversation. I could just fill pages like this. I'm sure it's true, said Phillida. I cannot agree with you, answered Norman. Oh, but I know I'm right, she replied. I beg to differ, said Norman sternly. Now, that is the kind of stuff that appears in real people's books, she writes. I know this will never be a real book that businessmen in trains will read, the kind of businessmen that wear stiff hats with curly brims and little breathing holes let in the side. I wish I knew more about words. Also, I wish so much I'd learnt my lessons at school. I never did, and I've found this such a disadvantage ever since. All the same, I'm going on writing this book, even if businessmen scorn it. Now, isn't that just wonderful? That is her, in a nutshell, I think, her style, her first person, the directness, the childlike quality. Let's talk about her style.
I think, you know, that always makes me laugh when I read
good.
That. It's humorous, and there are always moments for humour in the diarist of, you know, episodes. But there's a serious point there too. When she writes that dialogue that appears in, quotes, real books, it's actually very trite. It's trite dialogue. And what she doesn't want to do is write a novel that would sell because it's full of people exchanging, you know, conventional opinions or expressing false shock and horror. She doesn't want to do that. She wants to do something different. So there's a serious point there as well.
No, definitely, definitely.
I think there's just one other thing to say on that, which is the way it sort of pours out of her when you start reading Our Spoons, all her books, you're engaged in them so quickly. Mm. I can't think of another writer who grabs you so quickly.
It's the first line.
The first lines
brilliant.
Are outstanding. Yes. Yes.
We've got a few books. Let's just all find our favourite first line. I mean, the first lines are genius. At the first line of Our Spoons, I told Helen my story and she went home and cried. Yeah. You're right in this. You don't know who Helen is.
Yeah. And but why does she cry?
What happened?
Yes.
You don't really till the end.
And you don't know until the end.
Which is quite fascinating. Yeah.
And another one that always amuses me is the opening line of who was changed and who was dead. The duck swam through the drawing room window. The weight of the water had forced the windows open, so the ducks swam in. Round the room they sailed, quacking their approval. And you think, what? You know, it's surreal, it's visionary, but of course you then realise it's a flood.
And then there's The Vet's Daughter, of course, which starts with, a man with small eyes and a ginger moustache came and spoke to me when I was thinking of something else.
Yes.
It's just
it is extraordinary.
But you're immediately engaged.
Yeah. And she's so funny. Yes. I know humour is one of the aspects that you'd like to bring out there.
I think her humour, I was trying to think the other day, I mean, when you were talking about, you know, how it can be very, very tough to read Our Spoons, but in the middle of it you get these astonishing drop lines of humour, which are startling.
Now, Brett, Daunt have reissued A Touch of Mistletoe, and it was originally published in 1967, and you reissued it in this beautiful copy you've got here in front of you, 2021. Let's talk a little bit about that, and I know you've got a passage too that you'll read for us. And this is a story of Victoria Green and her younger sister Blanche, and it covers three decades, 1930s to 1960s. So that includes the Second World War, which is key to this novel.
It's at the heart of it.
Now, it's a very different novel from Our Spoons Came from Woolworths. Tell us about this one and what...
It's a very different novel. I think in many ways it's a more complete novel. There's a much wider arc of these two sisters' lives. There's a wonderful scene at the end that I won't spoil where they reflect on their lives and the different paths that they've taken. But it really reflects an age where women were being forced to look for security and look to avoid the awful poverty that both Barbara and the characters suffer at the start by choosing men. And it's whether you choose for love or whether you choose for security or whether you try and choose both. But the arc of the book, and again some of the scenes in it, are shocking, but it's a wonderful book just because I think of that completeness. There's less humour in it. There's actually, I think, very little humour in A Touch of Mistletoe. When it does come, and there's a scene I'll try and read in a moment, that is wonderfully funny, where she's looking at the way the British performed during the Second World War. It's more descriptive, I think, than a lot of the other novels. It's not surreal, I think, there's no real surrealism in there. But there is this extraordinary dealing with both very difficult things in an age without the NHS, with abortion again, and then later on mental illness.
That's very specific to this novel. I mean, A Touch of Mistletoe refers to...
To madness or to something alien, really, that is growing on what in this book is a real love. I mean, there is a real love at the heart of this book, a very complete love, and one that might have had a future. This is Vicky, the eldest of the daughters. She falls in love with a young man who very early on in the marriage turns out to have some sort of psychological problems, and those develop, particularly once she's pregnant. And he's then treated, and I won't spoil it, but the treatment doesn't work, but it might have done. I think that's the feeling you have in the book. And then she's forced back to these awful choices that women so often faced during that era, if they were to bring up children or if they were to survive and not have to move every week or move into smaller flats or take on lovers who would take them out to dinner. There is that wonderful scene, talk about humour in this book, where the two girls who are penniless and I think staying in a hostel at this point, they get taken out by some boys, and really all they can remember about it is they get a sort of roast lunch, don't they, out of it, which is fantastic. And they never seen, she says something like, you know, they never saw them again. So there is that in the middle of it. But yes, for that simple reason, that there is this deep love at the heart of it. I think it's an unusual and very special book. She's very good on the war in this book, and very good on the descriptions of flying bombs and bombing earlier on. And she talks about one of the famous bombing incidents in London that killed so many people. And one of the key characters in the book actually is affected by it. So this is her talking about the Second World War, which she is at the heart of this book, and she covers wonderfully well. And she writes, during wars, English people tend to sing the most terrible songs, depressing sorts of dirges which are intended to be jolly. Then there were the people who took a pride in using hardly any bath water, and that almost cold, and talking about plimsoll lines and saying that all one's books should be turned into pulp. An old woman was fined for feeding ducks in a public pond, and a light-hearted girl in the provinces was sent to prison for flashing a torch in boys' faces. Once I told a man at a party that my grocer occasionally let me have extra butter, and he said that I was sinking ships. He was so angry that his eyes became crossed, and I hurriedly left. Later, I discovered that this man, who I thought was sinking ships, used to buy black market petrol from dustmen who siphoned it out from their petrol tanks. Then there were the people who loved to queue. They joined any old queue that was going. So, queuing squarely at the heart of British life during the war. But yes, it's a wonderful flash of humour, and again, what is quite a grim passage, really.
I must say, I was fascinated by the sort of her experiences during the war, living with this man called Arthur Price, who was obviously a sort of chancer, and it made me think of, I think it's Put Up More Flags, where Basil Seale says, I want to be one of those hard-faced men who did well out of the war. And, you know, they were into everything, weren't they, old cars, and obviously very much on the black market.
She learned a lot. Barbara Cummins learned a lot from Arthur Price. She had to survive in life.
Yes, exactly. He taught.
And he was very. I mean, Julian got on with him very well, didn't he? Yes. So he's obviously an important figure in their lives.
Yes. And Julian still loves cars. He's bought many antique cars, and he got that from Arthur Price. And Julian has mechanical skills like Arthur Price, although Julian became a set designer. And Price was affectionate and warm in a way that neither John Pemberton nor Richard Cummins Carr were to Barbara's children.
Yes.
Let's move on to Avril's choice. You've got a short reading as well for us too, because I'm really glad you brought this in. This is The Juniper Tree, which I haven't read, but I've read a lot about it, thanks to you in the biography as well. And you also, as I say, you sum up and write about each of the novels in your biography, which is wonderful. That's how I got to know so many of them. But The Juniper Tree, tell us about The Juniper Tree.
The Juniper Tree was the last one she actually wrote after a silence, an authorial silence of about 18 years. She thought she'd never write again, but she did. And the inspiration for the novel was the Grimm's tale, The Juniper Tree. And I want to give you just two short readings. One is from the actual Grimm's tale, collected by Grimm. It's called The Juniper Tree. And it opens like this. 2,000 years ago, or a very long time anyway, there lived a rich man and his good and beautiful wife. They loved each other dearly. There was only one thing they needed to complete their happiness, and that was children. But as much as they longed for a child, and as much as the woman prayed both day and night, no child came, and no child came. Now, in front of their house was a courtyard where there grew a juniper tree. One winter's day, the woman stood under the tree, peeling an apple, and as she did so, she cut her finger, and a drop of blood fell into the snow. Oh, she sighed, if only I had a child as red as blood and as white as snow. And I'm sure most people know what happens in that collected tale. It's horrendous. This wife has a child but dies. The second wife, the stepmother, hates the husband's first child. And she kills the child, and the child is fed to the husband to eat. So there's cannibalism, murder. It is really powerful and really horrifying. This is how Barbara Cummins' novel opens, The Juniper Tree. Quite soon after I left Richmond Station, I turned into a quiet street where the snow was almost undisturbed, and climbing higher, I came to a road that appeared to be deserted. Then I noticed a beautiful fair woman standing in the courtyard outside her house like a statue, standing there so still. As I drew nearer, I saw that her hands were moving. She was paring an apple out there in the snow, and as I passed, looking at her out of the sides of my eyes, the knife slipped, and suddenly there was blood on the snow. She turned and went into her house before I could offer to help. I didn't like to knock on the door. It was a very private-looking one, painted bottle green and with heavy brass fittings. Facing the wrought-iron gate was a carved bear with sad stone eyes and snow on its back. It appeared to be late Victorian sculpture, but the house was much older. Georgian, most likely. I thought I saw a dim figure pass by one of the windows, and I hurriedly turned away and walked further up the hill towards the park gates, forgetting that I'd come to Richmond in search of work, not to walk in the snowy park among the deer. Now, the young heroine who you meet at the beginning is 26, and she is, again, like many of Cummins Harris, looking for work, looking how to survive. The woman you meet, this graceful, beautiful woman who cuts her finger, turns out to be the very wealthy wife of a very wealthy man, and she becomes entangled with their lives. The first wife dies in childbirth, just as in the tale, in the old folk tale, and our heroine, the person who relates the story, becomes the second wife, the stepmother. But unlike the Grimm's Tower, where the stepmother is evil, scheming, a murderess, the stepmother here becomes abused by her husband. The child does die, his son does die, but it's accidental, and it prompts Bella Winter, the young wife, into a complete breakdown. So we have madness again, and she tries to commit suicide and is hospitalised in an asylum. It ends happily, actually, and I won't spoil. But there is a very acute eye on domestic abuse, the sort of subtle, corroding abuse of women that goes on behind closed doors. It's an extraordinary opening, and you know, if you know the Grimm's Tale, you think, oh, goodness, what's going to happen here? And it's a different... It's a clever adaptation of the Grimm's Tale, and it's a riveting read, and it's set in Richmond and Twickenham, very realistic settings where these awful things, but there are again surreal Chagallian moments in the original tale. A bird plays a very important part. It does so in this version too, so she adapts and amends and makes it her own in a very powerful way.
The men don't come out of her novels very well.
No.
They are mostly women's stories, children's stories. But, you know, the mothers aren't particularly nice either.
No,
it's hard to see a straight line, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes. And that comes out of Barbara's own childhood. Her mother was a very remote figure, and the children related more to their maternal grandmother. And Barbara was very close to Chloe, her sister, and got her sort of used Chloe as her confidant. So that damaging relationship with her own mother, I think, informs the novels in many ways.
Having said that, in Who Was Changed and Who Was Dead, she has one of the great monstrous grandmothers of English literature.
Yes. As I say, it's not clear-cut.
No, Grandma Willoweed is one of the most terrifying characters you'll ever come across in a novel.
Yes. And she's a Dickensian character almost.
Now, Barbara Cummins had a few champions in her lifetime, but as you've been outlining as well, it is a very checkered publishing history. She didn't publish one novel after another. She had Graham Greene was one of her great champions, but he didn't like all of them, did he?
He didn't like the House of Dolls, no. But he liked he very much liked The Vet's Daughter.
But how did she deal with all these publishing setbacks? Because she didn't always have good reviews either. And, you know, you do wonder when you look back and you think, is there a reason that she wasn't published as much as she could have been? I don't have the answer to that. What do you think, Brett?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know much about publishing in the 50s and the 60s, but I mean, one wonders whether the male publishers running a lot of publishing at that time, pre-Virago, didn't find, you know, some of her realism about the way women's lives were lived in that era uncomfortable. I mean, I'm not
More
sure,
than likely,
but I think that's quite likely.
Yeah. I think that's particularly true of The House of Dolls, which she wrote in the 60s, which was rejected by several publishers. And it's about some women in their 50s, 60s who live in rooms in a house, and they are actually part-time prostitutes. There's a Spanish woman who has a very checkered history herself, who's a tenant there, tells them how to attract men, how to get some money out of them. And they are on the game, really, in a respectable area. And I think Graham Greene, as a Catholic, might not have liked this. Didn't see the humour, it's a very funny book, and didn't see the social history, because it's made quite clear in the novel that these women who married and never worked and never paid national insurance, when their husband died, they couldn't claim medical insurance. They couldn't get medical help. So it took many years before the book was published, and some sharp-eyed female reviewers saw underneath its comedy, because it is comic, there was a serious point being made about why and how certain women fall into poverty very easily.
I think, you know, bringing this all to a close, this discussion about Barbara Cummins, I think Gail and Hazel, you may agree with me that I've been very much convinced by your biography, Avril. That's really helped me to understand Barbara Cummins. It's also led me on to want to read several other books. And it is this balance of the relentless, grim awfulness of poverty in women's lives, but also, for me, the style and the humour. I absolutely love it. I really do, and I will recommend them, but I'm not sure all of them. Mm. I don't think that everybody wants to read such grim, depressing novels these days. I think it's really, really hard. Mm. Gail, Hazel, any final thoughts on Barbara Cummins?
I suspect that you would have a far greater appetite for her books as a young woman in your 20s or 30s, when you're more cheerful about life in general and more resilient. I think by my stage in life, I can't take too much grimness, basically.
Hazel, how do you feel about Barbara Cummins now, after this discussion, but also yes. after reading?
Yes, I think it, you know, kind of speaks to the sort of power of her writing, that, you know, they are so painful to read, aren't they? And I suppose I do agree with Gail that, you know, we've both sort of reached a moment when we need a bit of cheer, really. But I do admire her, and talking about her has somehow, you know, emphasised to me how clever she is.
She was writing at a particular time as well, and I'm just wondering about the other women writers of that time. Mm. Did she have anything to do with the other women? Was there? I mean, I know she had a lot to do with the artists.
No, not really. And of course, she lived in Spain for 18 years, so she wasn't mixing. She wasn't mixing with the North London coterie of writers ever.
Which may partly explain why she found it so hard to get published at times, because she wasn't in the sort of the literary. Yeah. world.
And also, even the books that were well reviewed, and you know, there were some very good reviews, really praised her work, you know, Aldous Huxley as well as Graham Greene thought she was groundbreaking, but they didn't sell in huge numbers. 2,000, 3,000 at most, and publishers were looking to make money, as all publishers are, and so when a book was reviewed well but didn't sell well, they were loath to take a risk on the next one. And that happened with one or two publishers.
And that hasn't changed.
No, it hasn't indeed. And also I do think, I mean, I've used The Vet's Daughter with book groups occasionally, and I think she's a bit like Marmite. You know, you either absolutely love her or you think, oh dear, this is too difficult. But I would say they're not all grim. And even the ones that we've talked about, that we've described as grim, there are humorous moments. Yes. I mean, that the poverty episodes in A Touch of Mistletoe, when they're cooking things on a candle. There's a funny bit where she describes how her sister develops boils on her face because of this poor diet. And she had one on her forehead, which made her look like a unicorn.
Yes, that's a great
And also in A Touch of Mistletoe, the descriptions are often very funny. Of one man, he had a skin like cold boiled bacon, and one of her lovers that
she's very good on skin.
She is
and skin tone.
Yes, well, she was very beautiful herself.
She was
wasn't
extraordinarily
she?
Beautiful,
and she is so fascinating as a person, isn't she? Now,
yes,
Paul's biography sort of really brought her alive. I was terribly struck by the fact that on the day she got divorced, she had three offers of marriage before lunchtime.
Yes, yes.
You know, she was very beautiful and obviously very magnetic. Yes.
I'm so glad you brought up the fact of how beautiful she was, because it is such a key part of her life. Obviously, men fell head over heels constantly with her, but it is... It's something she didn't seem to sell herself like that, but she just was extremely beautiful.
Yes,
and when you look
at
the photographs of her, you think, goodness me.
Yes.
And she posed as a model, didn't
she? Yes, she did.
For several artists.
An artist model, yes. Yes, she did.
What a wonderful and very, very interesting discussion. Thank you, Avril Horner and Brett Wollstonecroft. Thank you so much for that. I think Marmite is the way to end that. Slightly Foxed is a small independent publishing house in Hoxton, East London. It was founded in 2004 by two editors, Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood, as a labour of literary love. Slightly Foxed publishes a quarterly magazine which appeals to passionate readers everywhere who enjoy engaging with a wide range of excellent writing, past and present, fiction and non-fiction. Slightly Foxed champions the lost, lesser known or forgotten literary gems and celebrates the offbeat and unusual. Its contributors are also an eclectic bunch. Some are well-known novelists, distinguished journalists or academics. Others come from very different walks of life. Slightly Foxed also regularly reissues out-of-print books that deserve new audiences. The magazine has a global readership and is always happy to welcome more readers. It's posted out four times a year to over 60 countries. You can take out an annual subscription at a very reasonable rate, and this also gives you free access to all the back issues and the whole digital archive. That's over 1,200 articles and growing. If you'd like to subscribe, do visit our website,
foxedquarterly.com. Or if you'd prefer to talk to a human being, then phone the London office. Contact details are on the website. Today, the Slightly Foxed family comprises magazines, books, newsletters, the annual Reader's Day, and of course, our podcast. Do join us. So, Gail and Hazel, we come on to the Slightly Foxed book recommendations for this quarter. You know, you've read Avril Horner's biography, of course, and now we're all going to be going scooting off and reading all the novels. But what else have you got on your list of recommended reads for this quarter?
Well, I want to recommend something which is slightly in the same vein as Barbara Cummins, in that there's quite a lot of gothic in it. And like many of her novels, it's was well received when it first came out, but rather disappeared from view. And I think it's a book that deserves a much wider audience, as does Maggie O'Farrell, who has written an introduction to the reissue. And it's called O Caledonia by Elspeth Barker, and it was published in 1991. The heroine is called Janet, and the book opens with her discovered, murdered, wearing a black lace evening dress at the foot of the stairs in a Scottish castle. And so it's not a whodunit, because you know that she's died at the beginning, but it then goes back to trace Janet's life from birth to the age of 16. And it's a story of an individual trying to find out who she is and what she wants out of life, and everybody else wants something different, and she's a rebel, basically. The story is set in Scotland in the 40s and 50s. The family live in a castle up a glen in the far north of Scotland. It's pretty grim. And it's a world of strict nannies and prickly tweed coats and drafty passages and Presbyterian propriety and the wildness of the Highlands. And it's an account of her life. And she gets sent off eventually to a boarding school, which she hates. She turns up at the school and she's a terrific reader, and she tells one girl with whom she's trying to make friends that she just loves the subjunctive. It's so subtle and fascinating. And of course this girl thinks she's super weird. It must mirror quite a lot of Elspeth Barker's own life, because she too was brought up in a castle which was also a school. Fortunately, she wasn't murdered at 16, and she went on to Oxford and then married the poet George Parker and became a very well-known journalist. But this is it's a magical book, and I was introduced to it by my sister-in-law gave me a copy for Christmas, and at the same time we got an article by her daughter, Raffaella Barker, who has put together a collection of Elspeth Barker's journalism called Notes from the Hen House. We've got an article in it in an issue this year. So it was a nice coincidence. And then with Barbara Cummins as well, I felt, you know, serendipity, basically.
Absolutely wonderful. Another one I haven't heard of, but sold. Thank you. And Hazel, what about you? What have you got for us?
Well, mine is really the lightest of light reads, I suppose.
Just what we need, actually.
Bit of light relief. Well, in a way, although it is a serious subject. It's by Ascender Maxton Graham, who's one of our contributors, and who wrote actually, I suppose, almost our best-selling book called Terms and Conditions, which was about girls' schools between the sort of, I suppose, the 40s and the 70s, and about that generation of women, you know. And this book is called Jobs for the Girls, and it's really about the same period. And it is true that it sort of, in a sense, emphasises the lighter side. You know, this is sort of oral history, really. So she's talking to people, you know, of my generation, frankly, who were sort of educated during those years, and also how they managed to get into the jobs market, if at all. And I suppose, you know, I was one of the generation who were told, you know, whatever you did, you must do a secretarial course, because then you might work for a very interesting man, you know.
And did you?
Certainly worked for men, yes. but yes, no, I did do a secretarial course. But I mean, what struck me so much was, you know, just looking back on it, the sheer sort of infantilizing of girls, you know, when they were going into the job market or trying to, you know, sort of typical reaction from a dad was, you're perfectly bedworthy, so there's no reason why you need to have a job. You're going to get married. And also, well, she talks about the various options which were open to people. She said she didn't actively seek out people who were, for instance, going to be air hostesses, but there just were so many of them. And one wonderful quote was, during their training, of course, you were told that you didn't need to be beautiful, you just needed to be in proportion. And also during the training, apparently they were told, you know, they had a rather sumptuous life, staying in posh hotels and so on. When you're in your hotel, there may be a knock at your door in the evening, and it could be the captain saying that he's run out of toothpaste. So you mustn't open the door, but you can squeeze the toothpaste through the keyhole.
Jaws are dropped round the table.
Anyway, it's very much along these lines, but it is it's both an entertaining read, and for me it was a sort of nostalgic read in a way. And I do recommend it. A good book for a summer read.
Once again, thanks so much to Avril Horner and to Brett Wollstonecraft, and thank you to Gail Perkis and Hazel Wood. Now, that's it from Slightly Foxed for this episode. Thank you very much to all of you for joining us at Foxed HQ in Hoxton Square. We'll be back in 3 months' time on October the 15th, when we'll introduce you to yet more compelling storytellers and riveting tales. You'll find all the books and authors we've discussed today in the programme show notes, easily accessed on your podcast app or the Foxed website, foxedquarterly.com, where you can also subscribe to our quarterly print magazine. Print or podcast, all of us at Slightly Foxed are united in our love of books and great authors, in reading and in rediscovering lost and forgotten literary gems. Thank you so much for joining us.